The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Given the familiar faces in the audience, I expect most of you know that Jason Rekulik is the former publisher of Philadelphia-based Quirk Books, where he managed the acquisition and editing of a number of very quirky books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, the award-winning trilogy, The Last Policeman, and the literary mashup Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Jason's debut novel, the Edgar Award-nominated The Impossible Fortress, was described by one reviewer as an endearing, full embrace of the late 80s. And his latest, Hidden Pictures, is his take on the supernatural thriller. Stephen King writes, "The surprises really surprise, and it has that hard-to-achieve propulsiveness that won't let you put it down. And the pictures are terrific." Tonight, Jason will be in conversation with Liz Moore, the best-selling author of Long Bright River, The Words of Every Song, Heft, and The Unseen World. Please welcome Jason Rekulik and Liz Moore to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. Thanks, Andy. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Liz. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to meet you.
Yeah, I know. We met like 15 minutes ago. I really loved your book. I read it pretty quickly after I received the galley in, probably like 6 hours. Like, I just started it and then finished it without ever really setting it down. Which I'm sure you've heard a lot. For those of you who haven't had a chance to read it yet, it is well worth picking up tonight or a different night. But congratulations. It's really a page-turner and also very kind to its characters, which I liked as well. Do you want to situate the audience in the story as much as you'd like and tell them anything that they need to know to sort of follow along with tonight's conversation?
Sure. You have to forgive me. I'm a little rusty at speaking to people. I've been in my house for 2 years. So this book is... it's a kind of thriller, so it's about this young woman named Mallory, who's from South Philly, and as the story opens, she's had some kind of problems in her past, but you don't know what they are, and she's looking to make a fresh start. She's about 22 years old, and she gets a job opportunity in a town in this beautiful suburb of New Jersey, and in the book, it's Springbrook, but since I'm here, I'll tell you, I sort of modeled it after Haddonfield, you know, Haddonfield, like that nice Wegmans and the... Cheesecake Factory, and she gets this amazing job in this beautiful house with this lovely couple, and they have a 5-year-old boy named Teddy, and he's one of these kids who's always drawing. He's always got his pencils and papers, and if you've ever had a 5-year-old that likes to draw, you know, like the drawings like proliferate. They're always all over the house like mushrooms. They just, you know, she's constantly finding these pictures, and at first it's like, you know, typical kiddie stuff like birds and rocket ships. But then she starts finding these images that are like increasingly sinister. Like, you know, she sees him like drawing like a man dragging a body through a forest or digging a grave. I think you probably saw some of them while you were, okay. And so she starts to become, you know, she's like, well, this is kind of strange. You know, where are these coming from? And I love this stuff. Like when my kids were little and drew, I was constantly psychoanalyzing their drawings. I think it's really fun because you know, and it's also really chilling when you see like the kid maybe having access to something they shouldn't know about? And I'm like, are you drawing that? And that's what's happening in this book. She's trying to figure out where these pictures are coming from and what they mean. And she begins to suspect, as she learns more about the history of this house and the community and this long ago murder, she starts to think that maybe he's like channeling something and maybe these pictures are telling a story. And what I hope you can see from the slideshow when we came in is that the book does have, I think there's 70 plus pages of illustration. And the idea is that they're almost like documentary evidence from this investigation. So anytime Mallory finds a picture, the story just stops. And then the picture is reproduced full page. So you're finding it as she does. And the book, I hope, you know, invites the reader to sort of study these along with Mallory and try to make sense of them and look for clues in them. And maybe you can figure out what's going on before she does. So it's a little bit of a mystery. It's a little bit of a thriller. I don't really think of it as a horror novel, but there might be a ghost in it, you know, and people die. So...
Yeah, I can tell you just personally, every time I came to a picture, this is what I would do with the book. I was looking for letters in the pictures. I was looking, actually, my kids are about the age of the child in this book, and that made it extra creepy because they were making pictures that looked very much like these, minus hopefully the dead bodies at the same time. Oh. And I began doing that to their pictures as well.
Yeah, it's funny, the illustrator who did all of the, I worked with two illustrators, but the one who did the real childish ones, he has a 5-year-old too. So in fact, some of that kid's art is actually sort of photoshopped into the book. Like he drew a couple moons and stars and things like that. So.
So is he going to come after you for royalties when he grows up? Or?
I hope not. He signed a contract.
I'm trying to think whether I want to start with questions about the art or this might actually tie together two of my questions. What was the first sort of like spark that came to you about this book? By which I mean, did a character arrive to you, a conceit, a setting, a problem, the art itself,
right.
Like what was the first thing that sort of popped into your head?
You know, this book has a really weird origin because it started, the impetus for it wasn't a particular story, but it was the idea of a collaboration. I think, I couldn't hear the intro, but I think Andy mentioned that I used to work for Philly's finest independent book publisher, Quirk Books, and I used to be the publisher, and I was there for 17 or 18 years, and I loved it. It was such a fun job, and we did a lot of stuff. When we started, it was four people in a room, and we couldn't publish anything because nobody would give us their books, you know, and so one of the things we did to sort of... To get attention for us also, we started using design and illustration and just sort of playing with like the formats of books. And so it was very collaborative because I was always working with designers. And so we would do like a horror novel set in an IKEA. And I'm like, oh, and let's make it look like an IKEA catalog, you know? And let's use blue and white IKEA type, and we'll use the Futura IKEA font because anyone can use that font. It's free, you know? IKEA doesn't own it. And so we would do things like that all the time, and it was super fun. And then when I left the job and I set out to become a full-time writer, suddenly I was in my house every day by myself. And I was like, oh, you know, and I found that like I was just kind of lonely and I missed the collaborative nature of working in publishing. And so finally I said to myself, you know, I wish I could work with Doogie and Will on something. And that was just the impetus. I was like, I want to do a book that's going to have some kind of illustration and design component, and I want these two guys who I really like a lot, who are my friends, to do all the pictures, and I'll write the words, and now I just need to figure out what it is. And then I spent like 6 months just sort of like, I mean, I was doing other things, but for 6 months I was like walking around thinking, God, what could this thing be? You know, what is it? And then, this is a super long answer to your question, but this is like how it happened, you know? Then my daughter, who at the time I think was in seventh grade, brought home the book Flowers for Algernon. Do people know that book by Daniel Keyes? Mm-hmm. Such a good book. if you don't remember it or you don't know it, the premise is there's this guy at the beginning of the book, and the book is his journals, and he has an IQ of 66. He's a janitor. And so his first diary entries are really rudimentary. It looks like a second grader wrote them. They're full of misspellings and grammatical errors. But you can tell that he's engaged in some kind of laboratory experiment. Someone's giving him this experimental medication. And with each new diary entry, his language gets better and better. His grammar gets better. The spelling errors disappear. And it's just such a cool device for a book. Like, I love it. And I totally understand why kids love it, why it's always taught in schools, because kids get it. You know, kids have, like, just gone through this whole same experience of, like, not being able to spell, and then they can spell. So I actually brought it home, and I was, like, rereading it, and I was like, God, this is so cool. And I was like, well, I wonder if you could do something like that with pictures. Like, maybe there's a character who, like, starts out drawing and somehow gets better, you know, and the pictures would get better. And then the book would have lots of different kinds of illustrations because they would start off really rudimentary and then they would get more and more sophisticated. And how could that happen? And I drove myself crazy. I walked around for like 3 months. I'm like, well, maybe this person's on drugs. Maybe they're taking like LSD or like, you know, psychotropic. I don't even know like what the words are for what this would have to be. But I didn't want to write a book about drugs. And then... I don't know, you know, there's some people say that, like, the mind, like, if you think about something long enough, you don't even know that you're thinking about it. Your mind is, like, working, like, under the radar. One day I left my house, I was going to the coffee shop, and I was just like, oh, what if it's, like, a supernatural thing? Like, what if this person got better, like, supernaturally? And I ran into the coffee shop, and I wrote down all these notes. It took me, like, 10 minutes. But, like, that became the book. Like, it just dropped out of the sky. I wish I could make that happen again. You know, I would save myself so much time, but like it literally just, that was it.
No, but I do think you're right. Like the months of work you put into thinking of the wrong ideas paid right. off in that idea.
And has that ever happened to you?
Not exactly like that, but I 100% agree with you about the idea of thought work, as being a very important part of the writing process. To the point that sometimes if I know I have a drive ahead of me, and again, with young kids, it doesn't happen often. If I know I have a solo drive ahead of me, I will sort of like count that as part of my writing hours and not listen to the radio or an audiobook or a podcast, and instead just sort of like allow myself to drive and tune out. And I'll do the same thing with walking sometimes mm-hmm. where I have no input, but count that as real writing work. And it's incredible how often... the quiet moments like that are when writing ideas arrive.
That is so funny. I do that too. Yeah. Like when I walk my dog, I'm like, well, should I work and try to think about what I'm working on, or should I just listen to a podcast?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Can you mentioned the two names of the artists. Can you say them again and tell us a little bit about who they are and how you came to know them?
Sure, yeah. So Doogie Horner, he's an old friend of mine. He used to be the art director at Quirk Books, and he and I worked on like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and the Miss Peregrine books and just a host of titles. He's an amazing cover designer and a great illustrator. And I mean, he used to work for me, but now he's like one of my best friends. And then Will Staley is someone, also a person I met through Quirk. Will is like a super famous cover designer. He's done like, he did the Madeline Miller book, Circe, Michael Crichton, Michael Chabon, like just tons and tons of like well-known books. He does jackets. But he's just a really neat person, and I just wanted an excuse to like spend more time with him and talk to them. So I'm like, well, we should like, I didn't know what to do except work with him on something, you know what I mean? Like we're gonna go like fishing or like, you know. He lives in Seattle, so you know, I couldn't really see him that much, but this gave me an excuse to call him all the time.
So how did the two artists then work together? Is one responsible for the more like primitive childlike drawings and the other responsible for the...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they didn't really have to interact too much, like because yeah. I was sort of like the middleman for everything, and basically one did the first half of the book and one did the second half of the book. But they would look at each other's stuff and, you know, critique each other a little bit.
Yeah. That's, yeah, the ones that get real freaky later on.
Yeah.
Are really haunting in the way that it actually reminded me in the best possible way of being a kid and looking at the covers of like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Different in style, but I remember going to like, I don't know if it was the Scholastic Book Fair or something like that, and being like almost frightened to even look at the art in those books because it was so creepy?
Yeah, well, then that memory? Book in particular, I remember exactly what you're talking about, because I think eventually Scholastic, like, they got so many complaints because the art was so disturbing, they changed it. Like, they had to, water it down.
That
so now there are people who look for the edition you're talking about on eBay, and it's really, really creepy.
Sometimes
and
it pops into my head while I'm driving still. All right, so what do you know going into the writing of any book, not this book in particular, but what do you know about story? It sounds like in the 10 minutes of notes that you took in the coffee shop, you got a pretty good idea maybe for the premise, the characters. What about the actual story as it unfolds? Do you, for example, let's talk about twists, which there are many twists in this book. Do you tend to know the twists in advance? Are those things that come out in the writing process?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't normally tend to know it, but in this case, again, it was like the miracle of just dropping in my lap, where I'm like, oh yeah, I think this would happen, and this would happen, and this would all make sense. I mean, the one thing I did latch onto pretty quickly is that I knew I was going to have a babysitter going to a new house in a new town where she didn't know anyone, and there's something supernatural happening, and there's a child, and I quickly realized, like, I'm like, okay, I'm talking about The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, which, you know, everybody has to read in high school, or used to have to read it. I don't think they make kids read it anymore, but, and so once I realized that's what was happening, and, you know, for people who don't know that book, like, it's about, it must be at least 100 years old at this point. It's about a governess who goes to a house to watch these two children, and she thinks the house is haunted, but no one else sees the ghost. And you're not even sure if she's, like, a reliable narrator. And so once I sort of saw that there, I started thinking more about, okay, well, what else does that... I need a reason for her to be unreliable, you know? I wanted to make everything modern. I wanted it to have to be very contemporary. This was going to be in suburban New Jersey, and they were going to go to the Cheesecake Factory and Starbucks and Target. And so... So I was always thinking about it as just like a contemporary, modern version of that kind of story, which, you know, I mean, you've seen this in, like, movies. Anytime there's, like, a babysitter in a haunted house, it's like the Turn of the Screw, you know?
Sometimes the way that you talk about, like, your own books reminds me that you have a really strong background in publishing from, you know, your years as you were you the founder of Quirk Books?
No, I was the founder. Hopefully the founder's here tonight. He's David Borgenegt. There he is. Hi, David. But David hired me, so
thanks. Good
huge
job.
Opportunity.
Well, in any case, can you talk about how your years in the world of publishing sort of informs you as a writer?
Sure. I think the biggest takeaway for me was, you know, when I had that job. And I guess this is true of anybody who's like a publisher, you're always pitching books. You're pitching books constantly, all day long. First, you pitch the book to your staff because you want to get your staff excited. You want the design department excited to work on it, the salespeople excited to sell it. Well, yeah, and then you're pitching your whole sales team, your marketing team, you're pitching booksellers. So all day long, you're constantly, I'm pitching my neighbors in the alley, you know? I'm like, oh, we have this new book coming out. You got to read it. You're at parties. You're always pitching books. And you quickly realize that some books are easier to pitch than others, right? I'm sure you probably saw this with, like, Long Bright River. Like, Long Bright River is, like, such an incredibly pitchable book, you know? And it made me cognizant of the fact that, like, the worst kind of pitch is when you go up to somebody and they're like, well, what's the book about? And I'm like, it's hard to explain. You just got to read it. Like, that is the worst kind of pitch, because the booksellers, you know, they're getting thousands of these every month, right? So they can't read everything. You got to give them something. And so when I moved into writing, I was like, well, I do want books that people are going to... I want to write books that people are going to read. You know? I'm not just going to, like, indulge myself and follow my flights of fantasy. I do aspire to do things that are commercial, which I don't know if that sounds, like, crass or mercenary, but, like, I think I'm just being realistic. You know, there's so many books that come out every week. And so I guess I'm always cognizant of that when I'm thinking about a story. Like, I'm like, is someone going to want to read this? You know? Yeah.
Well, to say that in a little less of a mercenary way. Also, I mean, it's like one of the fundamental goals of telling a good story is to make it immersive. And,
right.
you know, there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
That's for you. Use that next time.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
But, no, that is really interesting, and I think about that a lot, too. Also, like, telling stories to kids. I just read this really interesting Twitter thread by a writer of fiction and craft books named Matthew Salesi's. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter. Mm-hmm. He did the most, I feel like the kids would call this chaotic. He did a chaotic thing on Twitter, which is that he posited that it is inaccurate that you ever need conflict in fiction. So he got upset because his daughter's teacher said, was sort of teaching the art of fiction to her students, and she, her, his daughter, as far as I could tell, sort of got into a debate with her teacher and said, why do I need conflict? And mm-hmm. Matthew Salesi's, who's a pretty well-known at this point, like expert on craft, he wrote a book on craft, sort of said, well, you don't. And people tried to weigh in and say, you know, well, maybe if you're talking about experimental fiction, and he was like, no, I'm talking about all fiction. You don't need conflict. You don't need a bad guy. You don't need anything. You know, and I fundamentally disagree with that. I imagine that you do too. And one of the things that I think your book does so well is, like, there's all these different points of narrative tension. There's the tension about, like, Mallory and her addiction that she's still struggling with. There's the, you know, tension of this new love interest that she has. There's a tension, the tension of the fact that she really is, like, loves and cares deeply about this child who's been assigned to her, and also really is worried about the child's well-being. And I just found it so compelling and propulsive and page turning in the most literal way.
Did that guy give an example of a book that didn't
have conflict?
No, that's
why I said he was chaotic.
I'm trying to think of one.
You're gonna, all of you, go find, maybe he deleted it, but go find that the Matthew Salesi's Twitter thread. It's funny you asked, that was my exact question. And every so often, in the days afterward, I would go back and, like, find the thread just to see if he ever provided an example.
Right. Prove it.
He didn't. But I don't think that was his. I think he might have just been, yeah. you know, being a little trolly. All right. What does your writing day look like now that you no longer work in publishing? Are you a disciplined writer?
Yeah, I mean, I like to work. Mm-hmm. It's funny, I mean, the pandemic, like, threw everything into a mm-hmm. tailspin, and now I'm, like, just trying to, like, figure out, I mean, what my day looks like now sure. that I can go back out and go to places. But, you know, my kids have to get up early for school. They're out the door at 7:30, so I'm up. They require a lot of motivation to leave the house. And so by the time they leave, I'm, like, fully wired and ready to start my day. So I usually, like, leave around 8, and I will go to the Penn Library a lot. I am not affiliated with Penn, but if you have a Philadelphia driver's license, anyone can go there. It's a beautiful building, and they have these little study carrels where you can, like, hide. It's nice and quiet. Mm. So that's sort of my go-to place. I know everybody at the front desk, they're super friendly. I don't think they know why I come there every day, but, you know, I'll bring myself a little thermos of coffee, and I work there a lot. Now that it's nice, I also go to, like, Good Karma on 11th and Pine. They have, like, an outdoor patio.
I go there too sometimes, Jason. That's so funny that we've seen each other.
So, and I'll probably write from, like, I try to write, like, all morning, like, from, like, 8 to 12, 8 to 1. And if, like, I'm really in something, like, big time, like, you know, if I've got, like, a draft and now I'm just, like, rewriting, then I'll, like, take lunch and, like, then go back to it. Because mm-hmm. I don't really have anything else to do, mm-hmm. you know? and that's one thing I'm sort of wrestling with right now is, like, you know, I feel like when I was a publisher, one thing I loved about the job was you use so many different kinds of skills in that job. You know, you're not just using, like, creative skills, but you're using people skills. I used math. You know, like, I sometimes added things up, you know, or you're trying to, like, do, like, projections. And now I basically use, like, one kind of skill all day. And I feel like my life is kind of, like, a little unbalanced right now. Like, I need, like, something else in it, because I feel like writing for 4 hours is probably about as good as writing for 8 hours. You know, I don't know that I'm getting, like, that much more.
Your brain starts wilting after that.
So I'm looking for that, Liz. I just haven't figured it out. Yeah, and the pandemic sort of complicated everything. But
do you want to do some of my writing?
I don't think I could.
Do you ever do screenwriting? Do you have an interest in screenwriting?
That's actually why I left the job. I had a chance to adapt my previous novel for Netflix, and I was like, oh my God, I have to go for this, right? I have to. I've always dreamed of doing this. So I did it, and then they didn't make it.
Same, always.
I want to talk to you about this. And then, believe it or not, like, I sold this book at the end of 2020, and then immediately sold the rights to Netflix again. And they're like, this one we're going to make, trust us. Right? So I'm like, okay, great. And so then I worked on the script last year, and now it's done. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they're going to make it. I'm not sure.
Well, they also just like laid off half of their staff, I heard.
I know. It seemed like such a good idea when they bought it, you know?
I mean, Netflix,
like, they're like, everyone's watching them.
Nothing is a good idea in the world of film and television, as far as I can tell. It's such a crapshoot. But I'm so interested. I hope they do make it, because I'm very curious about how they would incorporate the visual elements of the book. I'm sure that's something you've thought a lot about.
Yeah, well, actually, it's funny. We did have a conversation about that early on, and I hadn't anticipated this, but you know, the pictures to me are like one of the most interesting parts of the book. I think Will and Dugan did an amazing job. And every time you get the picture, it's like a little piece of candy. You know, it's like, oh, I can stop reading and look at something. It's the least interesting part of the movie, right? Because movies are all about like motion pictures, moving pictures. And then these are static images. And how long do you want to look at like a static image? Mm-hmm. So they're like, you know, So they basically said, you know, just don't. We're not going to linger on them too much. Like the adaptation I wrote is really, really similar to the book, but there's probably fewer pictures in the movie.
They are more hidden,
right?
Okay. So how has COVID writing in COVID affected you? Has it affected you in a substantive way or no?
Not really.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, well, the one thing it taught me is that I used to be a little more precious about my habits, right? I used to be like, well, I can only write in the library with absolute silence or whatever. And then, because in my house, you know, the dog's always barking. Every time the mailman comes, I have a very loud and manic dog with anxiety issues. And my office is like right next to the laundry machines. And, you know, so there's constant distractions. And I'm like, I can't work at home. I have to leave my house. But when COVID forced me to work at home, I wrote this book. You know, so like, I can do it.
Right.
I just had to like, I just had to force myself to do it and figure it out. So that was the biggest takeaway. I feel like I could probably write anywhere under any circumstances if I had to.
What would you like? So you said like, I'm looking for a different, you think you need another thing or you need some other part of your day. Like, do you have any ideas about that? I guess if you did, you'd be doing it, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know. Yeah.
Gardening?
No, I don't want like a hobby.
No. I mean, that can be a lucrative business in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's true. I used to think I was an introvert and like, I think when I was like 21, I was like, I'm an introverted person. I just want to write. And I've been writing since I was like 19, I think, you know, like every day. But then working, because I had to work, I had to like make money. And so like working and publishing for like 25 years, like I had no choice but to put myself out there, you know, and just like, well, you may be an introvert, but you've got to sell books. You know, you've got to go out there and meet those booksellers and meet those people and get them excited. And I think it kind of like, I don't think I'm an extrovert, but I'm definitely more of an extrovert than I used to be. And writing is super, super solitary, you know? So, I don't know, do you like teaching? I mean, you must love that,
I was just
going
to say,
right?
Are you leading into, do you want to, I was wondering if you wanted to
I don't know
teach.
If I would like it or not.
Yeah. I do. I love it. Highly recommend. I think it's incredibly rewarding, and I also think it's related to writing, but it's just different enough that it like does the thing that you might be looking for, which is, you know, sort of using a different part of your brain.
No, I think I'd like it. I do miss being around, like when I was at Quirk, you know, there were always like younger employees who like are always exposing you to like new things that I'm never going to find on my own, you know? And so I miss that so much.
I have two more brief questions for you, and then this is the moment when you all should start thinking of your questions for Jason and preparing for that. One of my questions is about your reading habits and reading life. Is reading something that you sort of make a conscious point to do as part of your work as a writer? And when you read, do you avoid or embrace work that you find it sort of either similar to your own or inspiring for your work?
I don't think of reading as like part of the work. Usually by 9 o'clock in my house, it's quiet and everyone's upstairs, you know? So like, that's usually when like I'll read a book for like an hour or two. Mm-hmm. And I do try to read, you know, I try to read what's popular, mm-hmm. you know, I just like, and then not like necessarily, like I'm not reading James Patterson, but like I'm reading like just like what, you know, what seems popular and what people are talking about, mm-hmm. You know, books I hear on NPR and what have you. That's how I discovered your book, actually, because, I mean, your book got so much press when Long Bright River came out. You know, and I'm always looking for people who are doing, you know, interesting things.
Yeah. Do you like thrillers or?
I do, yeah. I mean, I love thrillers. I love stories. You know, I think I'm a story person. Yeah. Like some people like writing, mm-hmm. and you know, some people will say, "Oh, listen to this sentence. Mm-hmm. Let me read you mm-hmm. this sentence." Yeah. And I'm like, you know, it's fine. Just tell me what happens. You know, that's what I look to books for. Mm-hmm. I love storytelling, and I wish more writers paid attention to story. I feel like story should be, you know, the writing I feel like is like the last thing you should worry about. Like, figure out the story, figure out what happens. And then once you know all that, then you can make the writing compelling. That's what I do anyway, you know. And then it's really fun because once you know everything you're trying to say, then you could just focus on, you know, there's no like, you just focus on saying it in the most fun and interesting way possible.
Can you talk a little bit about what's next for you, or if not in specific terms, then, you know, novel, more screenwriting, whatever you feel comfortable with?
I'm not going to write another screenplay. I think, I don't know, maybe I will. Never say never. The health insurance is incredible, mm-hmm. And very, it's $50 a month for my whole family, so you can't beat that. No, seriously, union healthcare, I totally get it. I'm going to write another book. You know, this is the tricky thing about publishing is they kind of want you to do the same thing over and over. I have a lot of questions for you, and this is something I wanted to ask you. You know, publishing wants you to do, they love John Grisham because he always writes courtroom thrillers, right? So like once you have one, once you have 10, once you have 20, it's so easy for him to build an audience because when you come to John Grisham, you know what you're going to get. He's never going to write a Western, you know? And so I'm like, okay, well, my first book was a coming-of-age novel, and you can really only write like that once, right? So then I was like, well, what am I going to do now? Like, I can't write another coming-of-age novel. So I thought about what I liked, and I'm like, well, I really do like suspense. I like thrillers. So if I have to pick a lane for myself, as publishing wants writers to do, I'm like, let me pick that lane. That would be a really fun place to be. So I think I have to stay in that lane. I just don't know like how now or like why it is. I'm like, does my next book have to be like, does it, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
I totally know you.
So how do you deal with that?
Every book of mine has been quite different from the rest. The Long Bright River, which is my most recent book, is also the book of mine that reached the widest audience. And the book of mine, I switched publishers also for Long Bright River. I moved from... My first book was a small imprint of Random House called Broadway Books, and then I published my next two with W.W. Norton, and those two were pretty standard sort of like literary fiction. A book of mine called The Unseen World delved a little bit into sci-fi or speculative fiction, but was still very much marketed as like literary fiction and hence did not sell well. I switched publishers. I'm with Riverhead now. And I remember having a conversation with my editor there who acquired it and basically saying, look, this is... not my first book, it's actually my fourth, you know, like, if I come to Riverhead, will I subsequently have to publish books that mirror the tone and style and sort of story architecture of Long Bright River forevermore? Mm-hmm. And she said very honestly, I think, she was sort of like, look, I would be lying if I didn't say that we would love for you to write books that have an element of mystery in them, because if you draw more readers to your work with Long Bright River, that's what they'll be hungry for. But she was sort of like, just write a really good book, and you know, it's our job to figure out how to sell it. So the book that I am on deadline for right now, that I have actually missed two deadlines for right now, is similar-ish to Long Bright River in the sense that it's highly character-driven, there is an element of suspense, and it's far too long. I need to really accordion it. That's what I'm doing right now before I miss my third deadline. But yeah, so that was a long answer to your question.
No, I've been really curious. I can't wait to read it. Deadline. And I appreciate you. You're on deadline, and you came here to do this.
Yeah.
And we've never met, so that's really nice of you to do. I really appreciate it.
No, it's a good mental break, speaking of what we have just been talking about. All right, I invite any of you who may have a question to ask it. It looks like there's microphones circulating.
Hi, Jason.
Hi, Nick.
About 2 years ago, during a COVID dinner conversation, we were talking about fairy tales, and Grimm's fairy tales in particular, if you remember that.
You
were interested in looking for fairy tales that had certain characteristics. And I don't know if those characteristics made it into the book, because I haven't read the book, so I won't mention them.
I'm glad you asked. Nick is one of the librarians at the library where I work. And he's also studied folklore. And one of the things that occurred to me when I was writing this book was, this is about a little boy, and you know, the babysitter is reading stories to him. And I just found like there were like elements of fairy tales that were like popping up in this thriller I was writing. So then like, for example, Mallory, the nanny, she has this little cottage behind the main house, which, and every morning before she goes to work, she sits out on the porch with her coffee and she watches the animals, and I was like, oh, it's kind of like Snow White, you know, with the animals every morning, and like these things kept popping up. So then once I was like aware of them, I was like, I'm going to try to fill this book with as many fairy tale references as I can, and I'm going to try to name check every fairy tale. And there are scenes that parallel moments in like Little Red Riding Hood and Hansel and Gretel. And it all just sort of felt right, because like fairy tales, so many of them are like horrific, like they're like kids' versions of horror stories. So like it just sort of like fit really nicely. And I can't actually relay the question I was asking you, Nick, because it gives away the ending of the book. But I was wondering if there was a specific fairy tale in which what happens at the end of my novel happens, and that's the question I was trying to research.
That's a sidebar.
That's right. You did come back with saying, I don't think this exists. So, but thank you. The Penn Library is full of fantastic resources. All you need is a Philadelphia driver's license, and you can get in, and you can ask your questions.
Can we just have a round of applause for librarians? I love that. That's great. Maybe I'll start going.
Hey, Jason. I had a question, because you've been a writer for so long and a publisher for so long. Are there things, you've been on both sides and simultaneously even, are there things you wish one group understood about the other or vice versa?
Well, yeah. It's funny. Now that I am a writer, there are things I wished I did differently as a publisher. Like, for example, I hate that this is being recorded, but I'm going to say it anyway. I still haven't received my author copies. And, you know, the book came out 8 days ago. And I'm sure they don't think it's a big deal. You know, it's like, well, whatever. Why does he need the author copies? We sent him one, right? Why does he need that box with, like, 40 books that I'm contractually entitled to? But, like, I kind of want them. You know what I mean? Like, it just bothers me. Every day I look for the mail. I'm like, did my books come yet? My wife's like, no, your books didn't come yet. You know? And I get it, you know? And, like, so there are things that, like, and I probably was not attuned to it because I hadn't, you know, had the experiences I have now. So if I, you know, if I were to do that job over, there are, you know, a couple things I think I would just be more sensitive to. I think I definitely would communicate more with authors. You know, they tend to not, I don't know how it is at Riverhead, but, you know, I wish I got a couple more emails and updates, you know, I'm like, how are things going? And so, you know, so I don't know. just one example of it, I guess.
Can you understand me through my mask?
I think so.
Okay.
So far.
Two questions. You talked about writing many hours every day, and I'm curious, are you always working on one particular thing at a time? Or like, what does that look like? And second question, I remember you walking around Quirk a lot with like a notebook and pencil, and so I'm curious, are you writing on paper, or are you using the computer, or a mix?
I definitely write on paper and then type it in. And then I always work on one thing at a time, because it's like what you were saying earlier, like when you're driving and you're just using that time to like focus on something. I know some people can work on multiple things at once, but I can't. I'm either sitting down and working on it, or I'm walking my dog and thinking about it, or I'm like driving around, you know, thinking about it. And I'm trying to apply like all of my energy, because books are so big, right? I mean, a novel is like so big, and you're going to make like tens of thousands of decisions in any novel. So I know other people do it, but I don't know how they do it. It becomes like an all-consuming thing for me. Is that true for you? Yeah, it must be true for you, right?
Well, I wish it were. I unfortunately am doing a dumb thing right now, which is I'm on deadline for this novel, which is a giant problem and process. And then the Long Bright River adaptation is still in theory in the works. And
did you do that? Did you write it?
I'm on the writing staff. Yeah. So I'm working on that, and then I am simultaneously pitching a limited series adaptation of The Unseen World, my book before Long Bright River. So I'm technically working on three things at once.
Okay.
But for me, screenwriting is such a different process. I get up at 4 a.m. every day to mm-hmm. try to meet my deadline. I don't know if you can tell this right now. But anyway, adapting my own work into screen plays or teleplays it's almost like math. So I don't need the same creative brain that I need for novel writing.
Right. I totally agree with you. Yeah. Like I could probably work on a new novel and adapt something I wrote at the same time mm-hmm. because it is not, as you said, it is like, it's like more like a puzzle that you're trying to solve or something.
We bought a copy and we're really excited about reading it. Here's the question.
Yes.
Jason, have you read a book recently that you thought was really great that we might not know about?
Oh, boy. I should be ready with an answer for this.
That's the question that is asked, and the answer, all answers immediately go out of my brain.
I know. That's right. That's exactly what just happened. Does that have to be a new book?
You want me to give one while you're thinking?
Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
This is a Philly author, a young author named Alyssa Song Sirride, Songsiridej. I hope I got that right. She wrote a book called Little Rabbit, and it's excellent. It's set in a writing residency, and it's about a relationship between a young writer and an older choreographer. And it's just wonderful. It is the sort of book that you may have been referencing when you said when you were talking about the beauty of the language. But I will say, it also tells a good story, for sure. And I just want to shout out that she is a Temple MFA grad as well, which is where I teach. So we're excited about it.
Nice.
Did you think of one?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about, like, the book I'm reading right now is a book my son had to read for high school. It's called The Cutting Season, and the author's name is like, thank you, Sam. Attica Locke. And this book has such a great opening sentence. It's set in one of these, it's set in the present, but it's at one of these, like, it's at a former plantation in the South that's become like sort of like a wedding destination. And so like they're sort of like celebrating like the old South, and like they have like people who dress up like in character as like slaves and like, you know, plantation farmers. And in the opening scene, they're having this wedding reception, very expensive, and a snake drops out of the branch of one of the trees and lands in the bride's mother-in-law's lap. And you just know bad things are going to happen in this book. You know, you just know, like, this, the whole idea of this plantation, there's a bad idea, and and there's a murder, and I'm really enjoying it so far. Mm-hmm. So, but I haven't finished it, so I'm not ready to recommend it.
I read an excerpt. I read that scene. I didn't read the book, but I read the scene, and I don't know who excerpted it or why I read it, but it's such a amazing scene.
That's how you open a novel. My kind of book, you open a novel with a snake landing and
snake drops
some mother-in-law's lap.
Yeah, right.
Hey, Jason, so what did your kids think of the book? I mean, were they like, what were you thinking about our drawings as kids?
You know, it's funny you asked that question. When I was working on the book, I had all these pictures. They're all clues. And so I have this wall in my office, and I would, as the pictures came in from the illustrators, I would tape them up. And it looked like one of these, like, when you see these movies about, like, the Zodiac killers, and, like, the cops put, like, all the pictures on the wall, you know, and, like, they connect them with threads and things like that. That's what this wall looked like, because I had 75 pictures with, like, arrows and lines. And it's also the room that during the pandemic, when my daughter was doing virtual dance lessons, like, she needed a room to bring her dance bar in, and my office was the only room that could do it, but she wouldn't go in if I had the pictures up. So she's like, I'm not going to be in the room with those weird pictures. And so I took them down, I put them back up, I took them down, and they were she was a little disturbed by it.
Hey, Jason. I'm excited to read the book. It's Kathy.
Oh, hey, Kathy.
I don't know if you can see me. And Liz, we haven't met, but I've read your books and really enjoyed them.
Oh, yeah, she's a big fan of yours.
Oh, thank you so much.
I am a big fan, yes. So you both have written about addiction issues, presumably as non-addicted people. And I'd like to just understand how you approach that. Like, how did you educate yourself about it? How did you think about the characters and their addictions?
I'll go first. I think you're going to have a better answer than I do. My answer is pretty simple. My wife's sister, about 10 years ago, she started working in a lab that was staffed entirely by people in recovery. And so it's kind of a cool business, and she's a doctor herself, and she would just, you know, we'd see her like at Christmas and Thanksgiving. She'd tell me these stories about OxyContin and prescription painkillers. And this is long before, like, you know, Dope Sick and, like, everybody knows about the Sackler family now, but 10 years ago, she was telling me these stories about, you know, the stuff, and you know, these stories that just were heartbreaking. And so when I was thinking about the turn of the screw and, you know, what reason I was going to have to make my character unreliable, I was like, oh, this seems like a really contemporary thing that I can use to make my story feel super up to the minute. I was always trying to make it feel as contemporary as possible. I am dying to hear your answer for this one.
There were a few different sources of inspiration behind Long Bright River, one of which is that I publicly have said many times over that I come from a family with a long history of addiction, a multi-generational history of addiction, and therefore, as a kid and into the present, addiction is a big topic of conversation within my family. And then also in 2009, I began going to Kensington here in Philadelphia first to do a sort of photo journalism or photo essay project in which I interviewed a lot of the residents of Kensington and got their oral histories at the same time that a photographer was making their portraits, and subsequently begin returning there in order to do community work. I led free writing workshops at the Thea Bowman Center, which is a women's day shelter affiliated with St. Francis Inn in Kensington, if anyone's familiar with that. It is not the Thea Bowman Center is not operating right now due to COVID and a number of other reasons, but St. Francis Inn is operating every single day. It has not closed one day during the pandemic. It serves its community and has been doing so for decades at this point. And so being in and around Kensington and also, I guess, my family's history are sort of informed some of the scenes and themes in Long Bright River.
Jason, how you doing? My name is John. Longtime fan. Really love The Impossible Fortress. Thank you. I have a question for you. You work with two different illustrators in Doogie Horner and Will Staley. You obviously had something in your head when you were writing it. So when you collaborated with them, how did you figure that out? Did you give them any instruction ahead of time? Did they come to you with their illustrations and then you navigated that? How did you do that? Because it would be interesting if everything you had in your head was what they hit the first time. So how'd you manage to work through that?
Yeah, everything they did was better than what I had in my head. I mean, like, I would sometimes I'd give them something very specific because it was like a plot point. Like, I'd be like, okay, I need a picture of X. And other times I would just give them, like, broader parameters, like, you know, something is happening here. Just give me, like, normal little kid stuff, you know, or, like, you know. That's hard to explain, but, like... I tried to give them as much free rein as possible because I knew that, like, with my own limited visual imagination, I you know, they were going to do better stuff than I could imagine. Really nice surprise is that, you know, often they would just, you know, because they were reading the book as I was writing it, I would give them chapters with the illustration request, so they would have some context for, like, why a picture was showing up. And they would have their own ideas, and they would include things in the pictures that I hadn't anticipated, and then I would go back and rewrite the text, like, to sort of tie everything together. I didn't really know what I knew this book should end with a picture. Oh, and if you get the book, please don't look at the pictures at the back. I need to say this in every event I do. There are spoilers in the pictures toward the end of the book, and I know it's, like, your natural inclination to, like, read the acknowledgments or, like, just flip around. Don't look at the end. But I knew that the book had to end with a picture, but I didn't know what it was going to be. And then when I saw one of the first ones, I thought, oh, there could be this really cool visual symmetry. I don't know if you know the one I'm talking about, but so the last picture is like an inversion of, like, one of the first pictures you see. And so stuff like that happened a lot. Like, I would just see the pictures and they would give me ideas for, like, other things that we could do. And we did an event last week. It was a virtual one, but it was really fun because they brought all their outtakes. Like, there are, like, 200 pictures that we didn't use. And it took a long time to, you know, there's a lot of different styles in the book. There's, like, a more sophisticated art style, but the hardest ones were actually the little kid stuff. It was really hard to get a style that looked convincingly kid-like and, like, accurate enough. If you know what I mean. I mean, I hope we got, like, you know, one of the early versions, like, the kid characters, they had elbows and knees, and I'm like, no, kids don't, kids never draw elbows, you know? So there was a lot of going back and forth until we landed on the style we had. It was super fun.
Jason, I'll make mine quick, because you may not be able to answer this. There were so many plot twists that I feel like some of them must have been surprises. You described this 10-minute, inspiration where the whole story sort of fell into your lap.
Revelry, yeah.
But certainly during the writing of it, some of those plot twists seem so surprising to me as a reader. I can't imagine that you yourself weren't surprised when you were writing the book. Were there any particular places that...
No, I mean, again, like, Sam, it was a miracle. Like, it just, like, happened. I don't know how it happened. I think it's because I walked around for 4 months trying to figure it out, and then, like, but all of the big plot twists in the book, I kept the notes from that day in the coffee shop. I hope it happens again to me someday. You know, it was the weirdest thing.
Congrats on the book, Jason.
Thank you, David.
And the, I'm curious how the Stephen King thing happened. And then, more importantly, is there anything you can ask the people in the room to do in terms of getting him to retweet it again and again to make the book a big hit? Because this is not online, so you could get us all to, like, do things. And anyway,
I'll tell you how the Stephen King thing happened. I knew someone who knew someone who knew someone who knew him, right? And so I literally, before Christmas, I passed the book, and it was like throwing a message in a bottle into the ocean. I was like, well, I hope it reaches him. I don't know. Like, there's all these steps along the way where you can, like, break down and not get to him. So I'm like, it's probably not going to happen. But then I was like, you know what? You know, this is the thing. When you have a book come out, your publisher's like, can you get any famous people to say something nice about it? And so I was like, well, when I worked in publishing, I was at a I used to go to Comic-Con in San Diego all the time, and I would work the booth, and I would sell the books. And Joe Hill came to the booth one day. And Joe Hill is Stephen King's son. He writes horror stories, and I really like him a lot. And so I was so excited. I said, look, what books do you want? Anything. Take whatever you want. I'll give it all to you, right? And so he walks away with a stack of books. And I'm like, you know, I'm gonna see if he remembers me. So I send him a letter, and I say, dear Joe Hill, you probably don't remember this, but I gave you a bunch of free books at Comic-Con a couple of years ago. I have a book now. Would you be willing to look at it? Again, this is Stephen King's son. And so he says, I'm sorry, man, I'm on deadline, I'm really busy. I wish I could help you, but you know, I'm busy. And I'm like, that's okay, it's a big ask, don't worry about it. Thanks, keep up the good work. And then, New Year's Day, I get this email from Joe Hill, Stephen King's son. He's like, dude, my dad's reading your book, he really loves it. Maybe I'll take you up on your offer. Could you send it to me? And so I'm like, your dad really loves it? You know, like, this is, like, great. Like, is he going to tell me that he loves it? And then, like, the next day, I got the note from Stephen King with the quote, which has been tremendously helpful because, you know, suddenly, you know, it's like this, it's like the good housekeeping seal of approval for thrillers. You know what I mean? And then he was kind enough to tweet about it last week, and you know, you think it's just a tweet, what could that do? But like, it is ridiculous how many, he has like 6.6 million followers. And that's how books get sold nowadays. He's incredibly generous. He didn't just do this for me, he does this for writers all the time. Really, really nice guy. I've never met him, never spoke to him, but I will always be a fan.
Thank you all so much for coming.
Yeah,
please
for
buy
coming,
Jason's
everybody.
Book. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.